Good morning. This is Jane reading to you from the Commercial News of Danville on a beautiful April 13th morning, very mild and breezy. There seems to be a lot of school news on the front page, so let's get to it. Headline, District 118 discusses student discipline. District 118 says their goal is to use student intervention to reduce suspensions and expulsions by 15%. District 118 board member Chris Easton addressed the board and public regarding student discipline before the board went into what Darlene Halloran, board president, called a, quote, lengthy meeting in a closed session. She says, I noticed that one of our students was suspended for 10 days, and the reason was horseplay, Easton said. 10 days seems a little excessive, but there's no single explicit definition of horseplay in the Illinois school code. Easton said he then viewed the school code for student discipline and requested to remove the word horseplay from the handbook. What I'm asking for is for us to consider getting rid of the word horseplay because I think it's not precise enough, and I hope our administrators will stop using it because I think it's not a good descriptor, Easton said. Horseplay is this fighting, roughhousing, or joking physical behavior, non-serious physical contact, without intent to harm, or behavior that is inappropriate or disruptive, even if not malicious. Easton added he did not understand why a student was punished for over a week. I'd like to know more specifically what caused such a punishment, Easton said. Many of us, if you recall your childhood, were not punished for 10 days by your parents for very many things, and that's all I'll say about that. Halloran replied to Easton before going to executive session to discuss discipline matters. I think in your three suggestions you had to use instead of horseplay, the first two don't cut it for me because they don't also seem to rise to the level of suspension, Halloran said. The first two, the last one, where there might be injury, that's a different thing altogether. So I would approve of that. There will be no votes in closed session, Halloran added. There never is. But we have a lot of business that we have to talk about, and so at this time we'll adjourn to closed session. We do have a discipline case. We will come back to open the session for discipline. Now, here's a story out of Chicago, but it could be applicable to schools beyond the city's borders. May Day battle. Chicago teachers push to cancel classes for workers' rights rallies. A tangled political fight over whether Chicago's public schools will hold classes on May Day is coming down to the wire, confusing tens of thousands of students and parents. The influential teachers' union, an ally of Mayor Brandon Johnson, wants educators to participate in protests in the nation's third largest city on May 1st, coinciding with workers' rights rallies worldwide. But the newly named leader of Chicago Public Schools has rejected the pitch to cancel classes. The standoff has created uncertainty for families of more than 315,000 students. Here is what to know about Chicago's battle over having school on May Day. May Day demonstrations are typically robust in union-friendly Chicago. The roots of the day, also celebrated as International Workers' Day, go back over a century to a turbulent and pivotal time in labor history. This year, U.S. labor groups are planning for a boycott of work, shopping, and school to fight the Trump administration's agenda. In some places, including North Carolina, unions are encouraging teachers to call off work on May 1st. The Chicago Teachers Union wants the nation's fourth largest school district to scrap classes for all, arguing that it lets teachers and students protest at a time when education is under threat. Unions are demanding more school funding, raising taxes on the wealthy, and ending immigration crackdowns. More than 70% of the district's students are low income. Most are Black or Latino. What our students need and what history teaches us is the only thing that works is educators, labor unions, and community groups standing together to defend each other and our democracy and demand that the government put our families over their fortunes, the CTU said in a statement. This week, Macalyn King, the newly named district CEO, said she had no plans to cancel class. "As a career educator, I believe every minute in the classroom is vital for our students," she said in a statement, adding that the district's school board could override her with a vote. Their next regular meeting is April 23rd. The union says it will use May 1st as a professional development day for teachers, swapping for one scheduled for June 5th, the first day of students' summer break. The union has filed a grievance over the matter. The uncertainty over the closure of more than 500 schools is creating headaches for parents concerned about finding childcare or scrapping test prep. A district survey showed 113 schools, approximately one-fifth of the district, had planned activities on May 1st, including field trips, sporting events, and makeup testing for advanced placement classes. Another 100 said they had other activities, including prom and senior night that day, according to a memo from King to school board members obtained by the Associated Press. Disruptions would directly affect academic testing and key student milestones, particularly for graduating seniors and eighth graders with limited ability to recover or reschedule these experiences, King wrote in the memo. Mariam Hafezi, parent of a middle school student in Chicago's Northwest Side, said she supports learning about civics and wouldn't be opposed to student-led walkouts, but she noted that these demonstrations were driven by adults. "It's a teachable moment without them being outside of school," she said. "It would be easier to spend time in class explaining about the strike in general." The fight over a single day off school showcases a difficult dynamic for first-term Mayor Johnson and a potential 2027 re-election bid. Johnson supports the May 1st demonstrations, but he has been less than clear publicly about whether classes should be canceled. His office didn't respond to an email Friday. A former CTU organizer, Johnson was elected in 2023 with the union's support. That relationship has created tensions, particularly last year amid contract negotiations and the ouster of the then CEO Pedro Martinez. After a rocky search for a replacement, the board named King, a district insider who served as interim CEO. Last week, the board approved her three-year contract. And here's some nice news from the Danville Noon Rotary Club. The Tonya Hill is presented with the Garmin Fellowship Award. The Danville Noon Rotary Club honored a pair charitable organizations on Monday, as well as presented the 2025 Gil Garmin Fellowship Award. Tonya Hill, who joined the Danville Rotary Club in 2009, was presented with the Gil Garmin Fellowship Award. Being a part of the Rotary has been a cornerstone of Hill's professional life. Through Rotary, she was able to form many lasting relationships and strengthen her community involvement. Hill was nominated and selected for this honor in recognition of her longstanding commitment to the Rotary motto of service above self. Justice Rita B. Garmin, retired, attended the ceremony to present the award, noting, "Tonya has held every office and has been involved in every Rotary community service project. She is a true example of what Rotary stands for." Tonya recently served as club president from 2024 to 25. Her dedication, leadership, and spirit of fellowship continue to inspire those around her. Gil Garmin was known as one of the most memorable fellowship speakers to ever take the podium at the Danville Rotary Club. Garmin was admired for his sharp wit and warm presence, making him a frequently requested speaker and MC. "Because fellowship is a core value of Rotary, this award honors a Rotarian who best embodies those ideals." At the start of the meeting, checks were presented to Patsy Jones with The Dwelling Place and D. Ann Ryan with Sleep in Heavenly Peace from funds raised at the Rotary auction. Rick Rotramel, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, reminded the group that flags for each of the 2026 Memorial Way project are on sale for $5 each. Corporate sponsorships are also available. Proceeds from the flag sales support Rotary community service projects and provide scholarships for veterans and their families. Flags can be purchased through May 18th at rotaryflag.com. That's one word, rotaryflag.com. Noon Rotary meets the first Monday of every month at noon at WorkSource Enterprises. All are welcome and encouraged to join. And since it's April, I guess I have to pronounce the word taxes. Here's a piece from our neighbors in Indiana. Indiana suspends sales tax on gasoline for 30 days. Governor Mike Braun issued an executive order Wednesday to enact a 30-day suspension of the 7% sales tax on gasoline, with the potential for extensions. Quote, I am declaring a gas tax holiday to give Hoosiers relief from the pain at the pump from high gas prices, Braun said in a news release. Affordability is my top priority. The order is in effect now through May 8th. Braun called on retailers to pass savings directly to customers, noting the state will be monitoring prices to make sure. Taxes on fuel in Indiana are made up of the federal gas tax of 18.4 cents per gallon, the state excise tax of 36 cents per gallon, and the 7% sales tax. The current average cost for a gallon of gas in Indiana, according to the AAA, is $4.14, of which about 17 cents is attributable to the sales tax. Braun estimated savings for Hoosiers could reach $50 million in a month. He will revisit the emergency declaration in 30 days. Attorney General Todd Rokita also announced that his office will actively monitor fuel prices across the state and enforce price gouging protections. Hoosiers deserve the full relief intended by this emergency measure, and we will use every tool at our disposal to ensure that the removal of the tax translates into lower prices at the pump, and that consumers are not taken advantage of during this time, Rokita said in a news release. If a consumer suspects that a gas station in Indiana is still charging tax during the suspension, they should file a consumer complaint with our office. In 2000, then-Governor Frank O'Bannon suspended the sales tax on gasoline for two 60-day periods heading into an election. It saved motorists more than $46 million. At that time, gas was nearing $2 a gallon. The savings were between 8 and 10 cents per gallon. That gives you a little perspective, doesn't it, between the year 2000 and now. And here's an article, this time relating to property taxes. State Representative Brandon Schweitzer, a Republican of Danville, issued the following statement in response to Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker's recent comments on property taxes following the release of a report from the Cook County Treasurer's Office titled How State Laws Failed to Stop Decades of Skyrocketing Property Taxes. The report found that Cook County property taxes have increased faster than both inflation and wage growth over the past 30 years, rising 182% since 1995. It also identified loopholes in various state laws, including the Property Tax Extension Limitation Law, or PTEL, that have allowed the tax burden to grow to unsustainable levels. In response, Governor Pritzker told reporters the issue lies with school districts, noting that more than half of property tax bills go towards schools. He argued that districts have failed to reduce property taxes despite increased state funding. You know what? School boards didn't take the hint, said Pritzker, and so they've continued to ratchet up property taxes over and over again, and that has led to a continued very high property tax burden on homeowners across the state. Representative Schweitzer, an advocate for reducing the property tax burden, has co-sponsored and supported several measures aimed at lowering property taxes. These include raising the income threshold for the senior freeze, expanding property tax relief for the disabled, first responders, and eliminating the estate tax. While the governor continues to shift blame to the local level for high property tax burdens, he overlooks how his own policies have contributed to the rising costs squeezing residents, Schweitzer said. Regardless of where the blame lies, the reality is that homeowners are being saddled with an unsustainable tax burden that must be significantly reduced. Schweitzer noted that property tax reform and relief measures have bipartisan and bicameral support, yet none of the bills he has backed have been called for a vote. When Springfield pushes costs onto local communities without providing real relief, local governments are forced to make difficult decisions, Schweitzer said. Too often, those decisions result in higher taxes and fees to close the gap. Calling property taxes a local issue simply shifts the responsibility, while Illinois families continue to pay the price. It's time to move past the wordplay and deliver meaningful relief. Now, a few obituaries and notices. First, Arnold Edward Sumaila, hope I'm pronouncing that right, S-U-M-I-L-A, passed away peacefully at his home in Westville, Illinois, on April 4th, 2026. He was born on September 9th, 1940. He was a devoted member of St. Mary's Catholic Church, the Westville American Legion Post 51, and the Knights of Columbus. Arnie generously gave his time volunteering at the St. Mary's Fish Fry dinners and Labor Day events, always ready to lend a hand. His kindness, generosity, and warm sense of humor left a lasting impression on all those who had the privilege of knowing him. Visitation will be held on Sunday, April 12th, I guess that was yesterday, from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Sorry, that's a late announcement. But in lieu of flowers, the family kindly requests donations to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, the Schlarman Academy of Danville, or St. Mary's Catholic Church in Westville. Next, William Martin of Danville died at the age of 90 on April 8th, 2026, at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana, Illinois. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, April 16th, at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Danville. Visitation will be from 9 to 11 on Thursday, April 16th, at the church. Memorials may be made in William's memory to the Emmanuel Lutheran Church food pantry. We've been hearing a lot about these big data centers that are being built all across the Midwest, often in a farm country. So here's an article having to do with those data centers finally meeting some opposition. It appears that folks living in the gently rolling farmland of southwestern Ohio don't want a 2 million square foot data center plopped down the road from their front porches. What's wrong with them? Are they snotty, not-in-my-backyard liberals? Not quite. Wilmington, Ohio is a very Republican region marked by modest incomes. Such demographics may have made the locals and other rural Americans look like an easy sale to the tech companies hunting for places to plop their massive data centers. Amazon Web Services is proposing this 9-building data center on about 500 acres of a former farm. It has its boosters hard at work. The project would create up to 100 full-time jobs, they say. It could also pay for up to $35 million in improving public infrastructure, much of which may not be needed in the absence of a massive data center. The Jobs Ohio website crows that the data centers, quote, create positive economic momentum by generating jobs and attracting talented people. People the locals may never have noticed were missing. Touting 100 jobs could also be read as only 100 jobs. The controversies in southwestern Ohio are being repeated in rural communities across the country. Their land is cheap, incomes are not great, and their local officials seem not too picky about the economic development. In addition, some states like Ohio are waiving big tax incentives at big tech. It seems that many rural Americans regard modest incomes as the price they are willing to pay to live in God's country. Some families have been there for generations, and many want to keep it peaceful for future generations. No doubt, artificial intelligence is taking over, and Americans can't stop it and shouldn't want to. It will be essential for national security and economic survival. AI needs these data centers for power, but it does not follow that human beings living in their path should have no say on how this all develops. Wisconsin voters have been presented with 4 local ballot measures designed to rein in data center projects. One that already passed gives the public more control over incentives officials may offer developers. Maine is the first state to pass a law halting a big data center construction for over a year. I'm not a fan of class warfare, but there is something unfair about the super rich dumping things they don't want to be near on economically struggling communities without giving a lot back. Amazon zillionaire Jeff Bezos keeps his Maine mansion on Indian Creek Island near Miami Beach. This exclusive paradise limits building heights to 2 stories, lot coverage to 25%. Residents may have only 2 accessory buildings for those essential cabanas, boathouses, and such. A little bridge connects Indian Creek Island to Miami's Barrier Island. People using that bridge are screened. Bezos cleverly threw out a distraction from Amazon's building plans by suggesting that data centers be put in outer space. That is in a far and perhaps never going to happen future. For now, Ohio farm country is the plan. As for Donald Trump, he's all for building colossal data centers, and fast. His administration has moved to speed permits for the centers themselves and the infrastructure they need. As for quality of life concerns, Trump limits them to within his own environment. In pre-presidential days, Trump called for moving the Palm Beach airport because he didn't like the jet noise over Mar-a-Lago. Some data center foes make cost of living arguments against them. The center's ravenous energy needs could raise local electricity rates. However, that could be countered by the tax revenues the centers would generate. Decisions on placing them should be based on more than the locals' cost of living. There are other values. And speaking of far-off decision-making having very local effects, here is an opinion piece entitled From Hormuz to Elkhart, Impacts of the Iran War. On February 27th, when the Strait of Hormuz was a free-flowing global transit point for 20% of the oil market, the average gas price in the Midwest was $2.68 for a gallon of regular. Even so, economic warning signs were brewing. The Elkhart-based RV Industry Association reported February shipments fell 10.9% from a year earlier. The association's president and CEO Craig Kirby observed, "The near-term outlook is supported by improving economic fundamentals and stabilizing the RV market conditions, with momentum building in the second half of the year to position the industry for more durable future growth." On February 28th, President Donald J. Trump launched his war against Iran. A few days later, he posted on social media, "There will be no deal with Iran except unconditional surrender." This war of choice put thousands of Hoosier active duty military personnel on high alert. The last time the United States invaded a Middle Eastern country, Afghanistan, in 2001, Iraq in 2003, it cost the lives of more than 200 Hoosier soldiers. Average Indiana gas prices have subsequently skyrocketed to $4.13 a gallon, prompting State Senator Travis Holdman to call on Governor Mike Brown to suspend the state's gas tax, which Brown did Wednesday. The last oil shocks in 1973 and 1979 pushed jobless rates in Indiana's RV belt over 10%. The cascading chaos we have experienced since February 28th has been extraordinary. While Iran's leadership was decapitated and its military assets severely degraded, this rogue nation essentially took the Strait of Hormuz and the world energy system hostage. A cornered Trump threatened Iran on Easter Sunday, posting on Truth Social, "Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up in one. There will be nothing like it. Open the effing strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah." That's all a quote from Trump's post. Historian Douglas Brinkley observed Wednesday on MS Now's Morning Joe, it was the single worst utterance by a president of the United States ever. Tuesday morning, Trump added, "A whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. I don't want that to happen, but it probably will." By Tuesday night, Trump pulled back. "I agree to suspend the bombing and attack of Iran for a period of 2 weeks," he said on Truth Social. "This will be a double-sided ceasefire. The reason for doing so is that we have already met and exceeded all military objectives." Trump called for a 10-point Iranian ceasefire plan, a workable basis. "It would give Iran control of the strait, allow its nuclear program to exist, and require the U.S. to withdraw from its Persian Gulf bases." Essentially, the, quote, workable plan is bogus, but it gave Trump an off-ramp from what would be energy Armageddon if the U.S. and Israel destroyed Iranian infrastructure, which would have brought a damaging response to Qatar, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq. At 12:01 a.m. Wednesday, Trump posted, "A big day for world peace. Iran wants it to happen. They've had enough. Big money will be made." Later Wednesday, Trump suggested U.S. business partnership with the terrorist nation to collect Strait of Hormuz shipping tolls. "We're thinking of doing it as a joint venture," Trump told ABC News' Jonathan Carl. "It's a beautiful thing." "What's my take?" "A lot is going on. We have a classic 2-week Trump reprieve. Then what? These types of negotiations take months, if not years, to resolve. The Pentagon has undergone a huge purge, with Army Chief of Staff General Randy George becoming the 20th senior commander fired since the war began. George's farewell letter described the need for courageous leadership of character. The U.S. entered this sequence after Trump fired his Department of Homeland Security secretary and his cybersecurity chief resigned in protest. FBI Director Kash Patel dismissed most of his agency's C-12 staff with expertise on Iran. Trump failed to build a coalition of the willing, as President George H.W. Bush did after the Iraq invaded in 1990, invaded Kuwait, that is, in 1990. Trump didn't seek congressional approval, as President George W. Bush did in 2002. Trump didn't consult allies until the Strait of Hormuz was closed, and then he insulted them. Trump has declared victory at least 8 times, claimed we won 10 times, said Iran has been obliterated or decimated 6 times. His deadlines and declarations on social media appear to be tied to Dow market cycles. Trump began this war with little public approval in the United States. Allied diplomats are spooked, and he doesn't appear to be grasping the basics, like knowing the enemy. Iran expert Karim Sajapour observed in an essay published in The Atlantic, "The Islamic Republic operates under a survival paradox. What makes the regime thrive makes the nation suffer, and what would allow the nation to thrive threatens the regime's survival. Trump is measuring this war not by what it will achieve, but by what it has destroyed. All of this reconstitutes the notion of the ugly American and has now positioned the United States of America as an emerging rogue nation. It breaks my heart to write that. Its commander-in-chief has lost control of events and himself. Indiana's RV belt faces a looming dilemma, but it may be at least the least of the Hoosier State's worries in the coming weeks and months." This piece was written by Brian A. Howie, an opinion columnist for State Affairs Indiana and the founder of Howie Politics Indiana. Well, a lot of that news isn't great, but at least it looks like we have some rain coming into the region, much needed, at least in my garden. I hope your gardening is going well and that you are enjoying these lovely spring days. See you soon.